Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Rachel Dickinson. Dickinson's articles about science, nature, the environment, and travel have appeared in The Atlantic, Audubon, National Geographic Traveler, and the Christian Science Monitor. She is the author of several nonfiction books for middle school children, including Great Pioneer Projects You Can Build Yourself and Tools for Navigation, A Kid's Guide to the Science and History of Finding Your Way. She recently published her first adult work of nonfiction called Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Bird, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, much of your interest has been in the realms of science and nature, and we know, especially in decades past, girls were never encouraged to be interested in science. So how did you nurture your interest?
I don't think I had any interest in science at all until I went to college. And I hate to give you a girly answer, but I'm going to. I met my boyfriend at a party, and he was a geology major. And I thought, well, that's kind of a neat thing. You're going to see a theme here where I seem to be following men in everything I do. But he was a geology major. I took a course, and I loved it. There was something about being able to go outside and explore the glades and the glens and look at what was just beneath the surface of the earth and try to figure out what was going on. So I became really interested in that.
Wow, so it was a sudden interest. That amazes me.
Really?
Yeah, and so did you start writing about nature and the environment only after you had studied geology and so on? Because you've expanded out beyond that, obviously.
I actually didn't really start writing anything till about 15 years ago. I did several stints in various nonprofits in the area, including a stint as a historical society director. So I got really involved in other people's things. And at some point, I decided I just really wanted to try writing some essays or small columns, and I did what they say you can't do. I walked into the Ithaca Journal with an idea for writing a column, and after the publisher got done laughing at me, he said, well, what did you have in mind? I said, well, I have 10 ideas right here. And he said, well, okay, give it a shot. So I had a weekly column in the journal for about 5 years, and that's where I learned how to write.
Wow. Well, what were you writing about?
I really wrote about life in Freeville. Now, everyone knows about Freeville because of Amy, but I told about the cracks in the sidewalk, basically.
Huh. That's just fascinating that when people come to think, I mean, you're such a good writer.
Well, thank you.
I'm amazed that it just developed so much later in life. I would have thought it would have begun early.
I think if you're observant, that I had years of observation under my belt, and I just thought it would be kind of neat to try to put this stuff together and try to hone it. Uh-huh. And, you know, really taking those, doing that 5 years worth of columns really honed the craft and honed my observation skills, because every week I had to write something.
Yeah.
Whether it was taking a walk down Johnson Street or, you know, petting the cat that day, I figured out what to write and how to turn it into a little story.
Uh-huh. And into poetry, in fact. You know, little observations turn into poetry quite often.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing in your resume that says that you were an educator or were ever a teacher. What made you decide to start writing books for middle school children?
Money. No, actually, the publisher for those books, Nomad Press, came to me because I had been writing a bunch of kids' space columns for the Christian Science Monitor. There's something about thinking like a 12-year-old boy, which I managed to do. So they let me write all these kind of gee whiz science, technology, how do things work kind of columns. I think I wrote about 36 of those, and so Nomad Press found out about that, and they thought, well, here's someone who could actually try to explain stuff.
Wow. And then there we go again. You refer to a 12-year-old boy, because we don't think of 12-year-old girls interested in some of those subjects, perhaps.
I think you're exactly right. Yes. We're of the generation in particular that really didn't think that way.
Now, I'm particularly interested in your book, Great Pioneer Projects That You Can Build Yourself. Was that a blast?
It was a blast. And my kids still laugh about the sod house made out of brownies that I constructed.
Are you kidding?
Oh, yeah, it was great, because I got to field test all of these projects. I had to make them up.
So I thought you did research and found out, you know, little things that pioneers were actually making.
Well, one would think. No, I did find out about various aspects of living on in the frontier and being a pioneer kid in particular, and what it would be like to be part of a pioneer family. So I took that information and I had to come up with 15 different activities. And I had kids make a covered wagon. I had to make this sod house out of brownies. cabin out of pretzels. I love that kind of stuff. I just love it. And my kids always laugh at me because when they have to come home with a school project that involves constructing something, They just hand me the paper and says, okay, get me started.
I'm sure it's a great tool for teachers as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I think it would be.
Yeah, I would think so too. Now, let's talk about your new book, Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Bird, and the Vanishing of the American West. First, tell us why you decided to pursue this.
I have been married to my husband for about 18 years, and I met him when he came to take a job at the Lab of Ornithology, and I hadn't even really noticed birds prior to that. And I think he encouraged me to look up. And so I started to look up and see these things in the sky, and then he started to gently guide me in how to identify birds. And life went along like that for a couple of years. And then one day he came home with a kestrel, which is America's smallest falcon, in a paper bag. It had ended up on his desk at work, and he was all excited, and he said, I have to build a muse, I have to get my permit, I have to do this and that, and I just looked at him like he'd grown an extra head, and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I'm a falconer, I just haven't done it for a while. And I thought, and you never thought to mention this to me?
That's amazing. And we're talking about Tim Gallagher, right?
Yes, we are. Thank you.
He's also an author. So this is how you discovered he was a falconer. And
yes.
It's such a, well, to some people, it's probably a strange little world. But let's talk a little bit about the history. You talk about it in your book. We don't know for sure when it began, but it was thousands of years ago. Tell us more.
Well, many thousands of years ago, there's evidence of bas-relief drawings on buildings, and there's various artwork that depict men holding birds of prey. And, you know, I expect that one day someone just was watching birds of prey hunt, and they kind of got it in their mind that, that would make a pretty neat hunting partner. So it makes sense to try to figure out how to capitalize, as it were, on what these birds were doing. So the roots of falconry are actually in the Middle East, and then they spread to the Far East, into China and Japan in particular, and then they come back west on the Silk Road when traders went to the east in search of goods. So as they're bringing their goods back west, they're bringing the idea of falconry with them, and it takes hold in the Middle East yet again. It takes firm hold there, and then it makes its way to England, which really was the hotbed of falconry in the Middle Ages. And when most people think of falconry, they think of lords and ladies and hunting parties. That is kind of the iconic image.
And tell us about, you focus on one particular falconer. Tell us about Steve Chingren.
Steve Chingren was and is probably the most hardcore falconer in the United States. When I wanted to find out more about falconry, when I wanted to find out more about what my husband was spending all of his time doing, his name kept cropping up, and I kept hearing Steve Chingren. He has these grouse camps out in Wyoming where falconers gather, and they fly their birds, and they sit around a campfire and eat grouse at night. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. So I just picked up the phone and called him one day and said, I would love to come out and see what you do. And he said, come on out. And he has turned into a very good friend. He's turned into kind of the source of all things about falconry for me, and he's turned out to be a really fascinating character. I knew I had found someone to write about when I met Steve. Mm-hmm. He's had this very colorful background. He's had many times in his life where he's had to make choices, and his choices always include, you know, wife, falcons, work, falcons, whatever Falcons, and Falcons always win. So you have someone who is just really single-mindedly dedicated to the sport of falconry.
Uh-huh. And he loves the beauty of the flight, but he also loves the blood of the kill, which you mention in your book.
He does. A friend of Steve's once said to me, "Steve doesn't feel good unless he's killed something today." I thought that was a wee bit harsh, and then I saw Steve out in the field, and I realized it isn't really Steve who wants to do the killing, but he wants to make sure his birds are successful. At the heart of it, falconry is about hunting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You can go to a Renaissance fair and see some guy walking around with a bird on his fist, and you can see a flying demonstration, but it's really about hunting. And Steve realized that early on, and he wanted to do the very best he could for his birds. And that meant he needed to go out, get it to a place where he could find game, and then make the conditions perfect for this bird to actually do what it was bred to do, which is to hunt and kill.
Mm-hmm. And then, and my understanding from your book is there were no laws governing falconry until the early 70s in this country?
Correct, correct. Falconry in the United States is really a 20th century phenomenon, which is kind of interesting because you think with the immigration from Britain in particular that people would be bringing falconry with them. But in the 19th century, in the 18th century, I think living life was just too plain hard to try to incorporate what seemed like a, almost like an erudite sport into your daily routine when you're just trying to spend all of your energy living. So it really didn't make the jump across the pond. And it, but sometime in the early part of the 20th century, there were men who were living in the West, and they started noticing the birds there and just really marveling at the power and the speed of these raptors, particularly these Western raptors. And they started to practice falconry. And the way most men I know, and most falconers are men.
I was going to bring that up.
Yep,
that. It's true, indeed.
It's like 99% men, male. So most men, when they get into falconry, and if they're of a certain age, let's say 50 or older, they got into it at a time when falconry was not regulated. And the way they learned about falconry was by taking a dusty 13th century book off a shelf, written by Frederick II, who was a Holy Roman Emperor. And he wrote the treatise on falconry. It's called The Art of Falconry. So every falconer I've met of a certain age has read this book. And the kinds of things that Frederick was describing and doing in the 13th century are exactly the kinds of things that falconers are doing today.
That amazes me. That
right.
Absolutely amazes me. Now there are three levels of falconry in this country. There's the apprentice, the general, and then the master. Tell us how somebody acquires a bird, and then we'll move on.
Okay. What happens if someone has an interest in falconry? First of all, they'll find out that it's kind of this complicated process to go through, and it's a long process. The first thing you would do would be to study some of these arcane texts and then take an exam. Each state has its own set of falconry exams and questions. So you take the test. If you pass the test, you actually find a master falconer to be an apprentice to. And the master falconer will make sure that the enclosure that you build for the hawk that you're going to get is actually in good shape. And they will sign off on all the paperwork and everything you have to do. Then you go out with the master falconer and you trap your first bird. And each state says what that bird has to be. Usually it's a red-tailed hawk, sometimes a kestrel. And you go out and you trap a first-year bird, a young bird, and you bring it home to this muse, and you learn how to be a falconer. And then after 2 years, you're a general falconer. And then after 7 years, if nothing goes wrong, you're a master falconer.
Wow, it's an amazing process. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Rachel Dickinson. We're discussing her new book called Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Bird, and the Vanishing Landscape of the American West. Is there anything in the test that these falconers have to take in regard to the environment?
Not really.
And preserving the environment.
No. It really, the exam that they're taking is all about how to care for your bird, how to recognize various illnesses, how to properly provide the proper food for your bird. It's of that nature. Different species of hawks and falcons, what the different prey species would be. But it really centers on kind of the natural history of the bird itself and nothing about what's going on around you.
Doesn't it surprise you that such a powerful creature, such an independent creature who likes to go out and hunt, would agree to be domesticated in some way?
Yes, and you can't really call them pets, and
no.
You can't really talk about them in terms of being domesticated. The way I like to think about it is these birds form a hunting partnership with the falconer. They come to recognize that the falconer is the source of all things. The falconer is the source of food. The falconer is basically even the source of light, because oftentimes falconers will put hoods on their birds' heads so that they'll keep calm if they're transporting them or at night.
Mm-hmm.
So they form, I think, if you can call it a bond, they form a bond. There's a deep animal-human bond between the falcon and the falconer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I take it that's the case. It just still amazes me. Now, you mentioned the fact that falconry has never been practiced by Native Americans.
No, it has not. It's one of those things. There are very few kind of indigenous peoples mm-hmm. who have taken up falconry, and I can't explain why or why not. Of course, in the West, many Native Americans use eagles in various ceremonies.
As symbols,
and they really recognize the power of these birds, but they've just never wanted to fly them.
Yeah, to keep them free, perhaps. Remember the old saying, if you love me, you'll set me free? I thought of that while I was reading this book. Now, let's talk about you and all this. At the end, you say you realize that you will never be a falconer because the older you get, the less interested you are in watching anything die.
Tell us,
how did this change you in any way in regard to what Tim does and the whole sport?
It, in a way, I found the whole experience really bittersweet. Doing the research was so fascinating, and being out in the field with Steve and with Tim and watching what they do was absolutely thrilling. Absolutely thrilling. But then at the end of the day, when I really thought about it, of course, it is about killing something. And as I do get older, I am just not interested in watching the kill itself. But that doesn't mean I deny the circle of life. It goes on. You know, this
right.
is what happens.
Uh-huh.
And when I see these birds that Tim and Steve have and other falconers have, these are birds that are very well cared for. And in the world of birds and raptors and birds of prey, that first year in particular, more than half of them will die, and up to 90% will die in some way. So when you're driving along the highway and you see those big red-tailed hawks on telephone poles and sitting along fence posts, a lot of times they're starving. You know, there are a lot of birds out there competing for not so much food.
Yeah. And you talk about that in your book, how falconers really are trying to save falcons. And falcons were almost wiped out by DDT.
Yes,
a number
yes.
of decades ago, correct?
Yeah, one of the most remarkable kind of comeback from the brink stories is the peregrine falcon, which really was extirpated, and the eastern race of the peregrine falcon was all but extinct by the early 1970s. And falconers, a group of falconers, got together and figured out how to breed these birds in captivity. These are birds that had never been bred in captivity before, but they thought, if we are going to save this whole species, we've got to figure out how to do it, and they did. And they just cranked out baby peregrines and took them to sites and tried to kind of repatriate them in these sites that they had been extirpated from.
Mm-hmm.
Very successful, pulled them off the endangered species list in 1999. It really was a success story.
Hmm. Yeah, that fascinated me, that part of it. Is there any oversight in regard to somebody who ends up trapping a falcon and doesn't know how to deal with it? And in fact is cruel and or, you know, neglectful?
Yes, there is oversight. That's why apprentices have master falconers as their tutor, as it were. You know, the master falconer is supposed to really guide the apprentice through all of this. There's so much stuff you have to do. You have to know the kind of trap to use. You have to know how to be really careful in what you're doing. And then once you get this bird, it's critical that you figure out what to do that first
mm-hmm.
week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got a freaked out bird, doesn't want to be in captivity, and you have to, and you also have to get veterinary care for it, because usually they have mites, they have all sorts of things going on with them, and you get all of that straightened out. So the Master Falconer is guiding the apprentice through that. Also, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is the group that oversees the whole thing, and those guys come around and they check on people's enclosures and they check on the state of the birds, because these birds, oddly enough, do not belong to the falconers. They belong to all of us. Mm-hmm. They're migratory birds. You're not allowed to own a migratory bird. So a falconer is just caring for the bird while they have them.
I thought that was a fascinating fact as well. Now, what do organizations like the Audubon Society think about this sport? And it is called a sport.
It is a sport, and they're not too happy about it. They don't really like it. Many people obviously don't understand it. They haven't seen it. They think it's cruel. They think you're somehow harming the bird. And then, of course, the killing aspect doesn't appeal to a whole lot of people. So the Audubon Society they don't like it at all. And there are some powerful Audubon groups that have tried to get various states to quit falconry altogether. To put the falconers out of business.
Now, are these falcons, are they like certain kinds of dogs? Do they only bond with the falconer? And are they dangerous around other people and territorial when they come around?
Yes to all of that. They are. I think particularly falconers who raise their birds from the time they were just chicks, these birds become very bonded to the falconers. And whenever they go into a place where there are other birds or other falconers, they get very vocal. They do get very possessive. Mm. So you have to watch that. And they're dangerous. Let's face it.
I was going to say,
big birds with huge bills and raking talons. And when you really see them up close, they're fierce. They are really fierce looking.
Yeah, they're amazing, too. They're majestic. They're magical to me.
They are all those things that everyone always says about them, but when you're up close and personal with a falcon, when you've got one on your fist and you look it in the eye, you think, oh, I probably shouldn't be looking in the eye. Is that like an aggressive thing?
Now, what happens if the falconer dies? What happens?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I assume that
can they go back into the wild and continue their life?
No. And you know what's going on is most falconers I know, like Steve and Tim, have birds that were bred in captivity. They've never been in the wild.
So they'd not be able to fend.
No, and particularly birds like Steve's birds, because he uses hybrids, which are a hybrid of a jeer falcon and a peregrine falcon, and they create this kind of uber falcon that wouldn't even be found in the wild, and you are absolutely not to let a bird like that go. And if you lose a bird like that, you have to find it because it's not something that's supposed to be in the wild.
And just to mention to the listeners, Rachel was talking about how Fish and Game check on these people. They do have to be licensed.
Yes. Falconers are always licensed, and they have to have a hunting license. And they can only hunt during the hunting season. So it's not like you can just decide to go out today, well, I think I'll take my falcon and go fly on some ducks. Well, you can't do that. You can only do it during the hunting season.
Yeah, I didn't want to make that clear. Now, part of the title of your book is The Vanishing of the American West. Talk to us about what you saw in Wyoming while you were studying this.
Well, I loved Wyoming. I was in the south central part of the state. And it's just beautiful because it's so stark and desolate, and there aren't many people there, and you can just drive for miles and see nothing but sagebrush and high desert landscape and cattle wandering everywhere.
That's wonderful, though, that there's still so much space.
There is so much space and, you know, big jagged mountains off in the distance. But then I started to really look a little more closely, and I was about 60 miles south of Pinedale. That's where Steve has a cabin. I was there one summer, and I took a drive up to Pinedale, and I started to notice natural gas wells. And I thought, gee, I'd like to find out more about that. So at one point, I kind of turned into one of the side roads that had all of these signs posted on it for Halliburton and Encana and various kinds of natural gas places. So I just drove up in there, and I found myself in this landscape that was completely devoid of any kind of plants and just scraped clean and just well pad after well pad. And this is an area that has about 3,500 wells now, and they're slated to have 35,000 natural gas wells. Once they figured out how to do a new process called fracking, which means they can go down and actually get some of the natural gas that's been trapped in there, this new technology allows them to extract that. And so people went nuts, and they started selling their mineral rights and their underground leases. And
Sounds vaguely familiar.
I thought it might be familiar to an Ithaca audience or the Southern Tier audience. So I was looking at what happens. As I drove around the area, I would see man camps, which were encampments of trailers where oil well and gas well workers lived. They would come from all over the West because these were really good jobs, and they would work in the oil fields and then live in these camps and work for 6 weeks on, 1 week off. They had various arrangements of what they were doing.
So you're finding that the Wyoming landscape could disappear as you saw it even?
Yeah. What was interesting to me was I was looking at areas that had sage grouse on it, because that's the prey bird that Steve flies his birds on. And there had been rumblings about listing them as endangered or a threatened species. Mm. So I wanted to go out and just kind of see for myself what was going on. And through observation and also talking to biologists, I realized that, these birds are going to have a really hard time coexisting with these oil fields. They're very noisy and dusty, and everything they rely on, which is the sagebrush, is gone.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And has Steve gotten involved in the environmental aspect of this as well?
Well, he loves sage grouse. He just loves them as much as he loves his falcons. And he probably knows more than anyone living today about the sage grouse. And he is so disgusted by the whole thing. He won't even drive into areas that have natural gas development. And he's written several position papers and long letters, and he gets nothing in return.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. Can you tell me whether you finished this project understanding Tim Gallagher's obsession any better?
I certainly understood it better. And I think I came to feel like I could be calmer about the whole thing. When he would take off at 5 a.m. with a bird in the back of the truck and go running through the fields looking for ducks or whatever he was going to hunt, I realized this has nothing to do with me and everything to do with him. And he is doing something that he could no more stop doing than I could stop talking. So, he just really was very wedded to this. And I love that about him. Uh-huh. He is obsessed with something. He has a passionate pursuit, and I applaud that.
Can you give us a website, a way for people to reach you and get a copy of the book if they like?
Sure. Of course, it's on Amazon, but I encourage everyone to go to their local independent bookstore and purchase this book. You can read more about me and about other things I've done at racheldickinson.com, and that will take you to various other spots. So,
well, I highly recommend this book, Falconer on the Edge, A Man, His Bird, and the Vanishing of the American West. Thank you so much, Rachel Dickinson, for being with us.
Well, thank you, Tish, for inviting me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.